Tarzan. Aman.
Well, the police fire chief, highway patrol, knocking down the front door with a big long pole. Sammy was a lying on the cold, cold floor, shot through the middle with a 44. Millie was a crying, Sam was surely dying. Bam, bam.
He shot Sammy. Bam, bam.
Well, the police fire chief, highway patrol, knocking down the front door with a big long pole. Sammy was a lying on the cold, cold floor, shot through the middle with a 44. Millie was a crying, Sam was surely dying. Bam, bam.
Good job, Sam. Bam, bam.
War Radio calling, War Radio calling. This is War Radio, P.O. Box 65, Fallbrook, California, 92088. Our website is resist.com, and you can download all kinds of radio shows from up there. We got Tommy's, Terrible Tommy's Country Show, and we got the regular news show. And we are at WarMetzger at AOL.com. And today we have a special guest. Yes, sirree. We got a special guest came here all the way from the East Coast. How about that? Now, you can call 760-723-8996. That's our 24/7 phone line where you can listen to a cool message and actually leave your comments. Yes, you may. Don't forget to subscribe to the Big War newspaper. That's $30 in the USA. $40 in Canada, and that's first class to Canada, and $50 first class to all other nations. And make that in checks or money orders of U.S. dollars, and make your checks to John Metzger. And if you'd like to pay by PayPal, go to warresist.com. Use warresist at AOL.com. I'm sorry, yes, that's what it is. WarResist at AOL.com. And our newspaper has all of our catalog of all our videotapes, audio tapes, books, flags, pendants, you name it, rings, it's all in there. Well, here we are again with Terrible Tommy, and I just gave you the information on getting in touch with us, and we're ready to go here, and we got a guest from way out of town. Yes, sir. We got a great guest that come in here all the way from the East Coast. First time, I think, in Southern California, Eric Glebe of the National Alliance and Resistance Records. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Tom. It's great to be here.
Well, now, you've been out here in northern Mexico for 2 or 3 days. What do you think at this point?
I think it's definitely Mexico.
Well, I'll tell you what. Now, we live in this little town that there's a lot more Mexicans than people want to admit to. But you know, this weather is awful good. You know, you hate to lose this weather and its beautiful beaches. And you went to the beach yesterday, huh?
Yeah, I had a great time.
You even got your little pinky wet, huh? What about National Alliance and Resistance Records? What's that all about? I mean, there's millions of people, I think, that know, but you tell them again.
Well, the National Alliance is primarily an educational organization aimed at raising awareness among white people. And we also own a major record label called Resistance Records, which caters primarily to white youth, disaffected white youth.
And you sell these CDs and DVDs all over the world, huh?
Yes, we have a huge customer base. We're huge in Europe. We have a good following in America. And our customer base really covers a whole cross-section of White Society.
Now, where are you located? Where's your national headquarters?
Our headquarters is in Hillsboro, West Virginia, a nice white area.
And you yourself, where do you live?
I split time between Cleveland, Ohio and Hillsboro.
Cleveland, Ohio is where you were born?
Yes.
Cool. Well, I was up to Cleveland a couple of times. In fact, I got to meet Dr. Pierce again after years. Years went by that I hadn't seen him. And I think, as I recall, we both gave speeches and had a good time. Had that big cultural get-together.
Yeah, I promote European cultural festivals once a year in Cleveland. And it's really a great way of bringing a number of people around to our way of thinking through traditional white culture.
Now, you had ethnic dancing from what different areas and countries?
We had dance groups from Ireland, Slovakia, Ukraine, and German dance group.
And they had these beautiful uniforms on, and they were dressed in that particular style, and that was great. I really enjoyed that. We don't see that out here. You know, if we had a cultural get-together, we'd get Mexican Germans, we'd get Mexican Irish, we'd get Mexican Chinamen, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, because they all went into the act. Well, Eric, I understand that National Alliance and Dr. Pierce, the leader now deceased, got his start over in Washington, D.C. I remember getting the newspaper attacked. Well, in later years, he authored the book The Turner Diaries and Hunter. And I guess he got tired of Washington, D.C. and eventually moved out. So how long did he put up with that Sodom and Gomorrah there, Eric?
There for about 18 years.
Yeah.
After 18 years of living in D.C., he had enough and headed out to the hills of West Virginia.
Yeah, moved out to West Virginia. What part of West Virginia is that? I've never been to West Virginia, but I'd like to go there sometime.
I'd say it's in the southeastern part. It's probably about 2.5 hours from Roanoke, Virginia.
What's the nearest town?
Well, if you want to call it a town, there's a old town there called Marlinton, which floods about every 10 years.
So that's the headquarters now of the National Alliance and Resistance Records?
Yes.
Well, tell me about Resistance Records. Now, you've got bands all over the place, and you're distributing CDs and all over the world and everything. How did that get started?
Well, Resistance Records actually was formed in Windsor, Ontario in 1993 by George Birdie, who, of course, is no longer around. Dr. Pierce eventually bought the Resistance Records in 1999 and decided to retool and promote Resistance music to a much wider audience. And that's what we're striving for. We have we carry CDs from hundreds of different artists, numerous genres. Basically, we cover music from every genre except rap music.
I see. So I noticed you've got heavy metal and black metal and the skinhead music. There's some ballads on there and just about everything.
Country, folk.
Yeah.
Actually, country music is an area where we really are looking to move into.
Yeah, come on now. This is all terrible. Tommy, he likes country music. I've been urging Eric to get into this country music for a long time.
Yeah, the country music audience is huge. It's perhaps the biggest market out there for us, and it's probably 99% white.
Yeah, it's a big, big business now, country music. So if you're in the country out there and you got a band or you're an artist that can play pretty good country music, I think you ought to either contact Eric Glebe there at Resistance Records or contact me, because I'd like to put together a big old hoedown concert one of these days with maybe a talent contest for country western, you know, and then get some real good artists and let's get them on the old disc, huh?
Absolutely.
Yes, right. And with this war situation going the way it is, I think it's time to get some good old war protest music going, as far as I'm concerned. And I know there's guys out there that can write lyrics to that. And like I said before to Eric, I said, you know, there's a lot of old lyrics from World War One and stuff out there that I know Dr. Kaldenberg had downloaded, and a lot of those could be dusted off and put into the modern genre, and probably would work pretty good, because I got a feeling this, if they're going to institute the draft, that they're going to be a big push by the anti-war people in this country.
Yeah, I think we should take the cue from the Jews, who did something similar back in the 60s during the Vietnam War, when they used rock and roll as a medium, as a vehicle to promote their message of peace, race mixing, drugs, and everything else degenerate.
Now, Resistance Records, so it's been around a little over 10 years, and you're growing and growing. You got some competition out there. I see there's a few little companies around. But in totality, there must be a tremendous amount of music going out, considering that it's only going out on Internet.
Yes, that is remarkable that, for the most part, no retail stores will carry our music. So the fact that we are doing so well from Internet sales alone shows that there is a huge underground out there, as well as a huge potential market. Right now our market is in, I'd say, the tens of thousands, but it's potentially in the millions.
Now, you, if you want to go up to your website and maybe download a clip or something of music, how do you do that?
Well, you can log on at www.resistance.com.
Okay, and so it's pretty self-explanatory from there on?
Yeah, absolutely. We have sample MP3s from numerous artists on there.
And what's the address in case they would like to write you and by mail? A lot of people, there's still a lot of people out there that don't have computers.
Right.
Or a lot of people who could that ain't gonna.
Yes, those people can reach us at Resistance Records, P.O. Box 67, Hillsboro, that's Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946, USA.
Now, Dr. Pierce passed away, how long ago was it now, a year or so?
July 23rd, 2002.
I see, and, you know, that was quite a great loss for Resistance and for National Alliance, and so suddenly you're in command, and that's been one hell of a job, I'll bet you.
Oh, absolutely, I've definitely had my hands full. The Jews, for years, considered the Alliance to be Dr. Pierce's one-man show, and they were hoping that once Dr. Pierce passed away, that the Alliance would crumble, but it's actually the exact opposite. The Alliance has more members now, it's more active, has more local units, and we're stronger than ever and in great shape.
You know, a lot of people might be a little puzzled about Terrible Tommy, because, you know, all of us guys in this struggle sometimes criticize each other a little bit, and I've said things about the Alliance, and the Alliance guys have said stuff about me, but old Terrible Tommy doesn't have members and operates more as just a loose leaf thing. You can belong to whatever you want or not belong. And here is Eric, their membership group. So there seems to be room for every way you want to do it.
Absolutely. I think there's no real answer to solving the problems that we face as a people. And whatever works, we'll go by that.
There's no actual magic bullet. I mean, it's just use whatever works.
Absolutely. Nobody has a crystal ball that can see what will work for us, and I think we need to be willing to try anything.
Now, you have every time you have a membership organization, one of the big problems you have is security. Now, have you figured new ways or new programs to try to secure check people out coming into your organization? Because, you know, there's so many infiltrators trying to infiltrate anywhere they can infiltrate.
Right. Well, I think the best method for that is to have a zero tolerance policy. If anyone discusses any type of illegal activity, even in a joking manner, I think that person should be shown the door. In organizations, yeah, sure, it's certain that there will be agent provocateurs who will try to join the organization and try to find perhaps some weak members who may be I guess you could say, provoked or enticed into doing something stupid to give the organization a bad name and try to take it down.
Yeah, I notice it's a lot of times in this struggle that people that act don't act too wisely. It's not, you know, I'm speaking for myself now. I'm not opposed to acting, but I'm opposed to people doing things that don't get us anywhere. And with a membership organization, that's even more of a problem because they can bring you down a lot easier than, you know, us sort of people out here just drifting around. And so probably if one is more interested in other means of sports, maybe they should be just stay an individual and be out behind the scenes, out there in the shadows, and then they're responsible for their own acts and they're not hurting other people. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Not everybody is an organizational person, and some people may work better on their own, and I encourage that for those.
With this Patriot Act 1, and of course Patriot Act 2 even looming before us, however, at this point, I think they're going to have a hard time getting Patriot Act 2 going. But Patriot Act 1 is really bad. It's really bad, and of course, now they've got secret courts and everything. They can come in here, and or at your place or my place, they can grab the computers. That's the first thing they do. And they can get an indictment through secret courts now that nobody even knows about. Have you've seen that, right?
Yes.
And so they've got much easier for them to dummy up a case against people. Now, we saw just what happened lately to Matt Hale and the Church of the Creator, which, see, what they did first was they come at him with some nonsense church group that said the name was the same as ours. They obviously were put up to it. And then in trying to defend all that, he gets all upset and everything, and then that leads him to possibly saying things about the judge involved, and then here you've got a snitch, an informant, standing right beside him, taping hundreds of hours of, you know, anybody in a fit of frustration, being pissed off, can say about anything. Well, I wish that guy was dead, or blah, blah, blah. Everybody does that. Go down to the local bar, and you'll hear all that stuff all the time about politicians. Well, they ought to shoot that son of a bitch. I mean, if everybody took it for real, most of the country would be in jail. So poor old Matt, he's probably, you know, livid because of all this problem. And so he makes a few statements, and now he's probably going to be doing 20 years.
Yeah, that's very unfortunate. And I think it goes to show that we should always remember that that there's always the possibility that every phone conversation that we have is being listened to.
Always consider every phone tapped.
Absolutely.
And then you won't have a problem. And, of course, you know, these cell phones now, I think they've all got this GPS chip in it to where they can tell right where you're at any time. So anybody thinks they can make a threat call or something over a cell phone, the cops would be there any second. So, well, anyhow, I was in the military. I was in microwave, but I also did some work in countermeasures, which is more sort of an intelligence situation. And we learned in the military that there's somebody does something, then you have a countermeasure. So there's sort of a not an arms race, but an intelligence race. And the harder they seem to hit us, the smarter some of us get. And isn't that interesting?
Absolutely.
And you can tell how smart people are because how few times the FBI comes to visit them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they haven't been around you for a long time, quite a while, right?
No, I think they were discouraged when they showed up at my door about a year and a half ago, and I slammed it in their face.
And you said what?
I have nothing to say.
I had the great five words, and I'll tell you, I haven't had an FBI man at my door since at least 10 or 11 years, and they used to show up about every 6 months. But once you tell them I have nothing to say, and if they don't have an indictment or a search warrant, they're gone. You know, and of course you never, if they say, well, why don't we come down to the office and clear this up? You know, do you watch any of these crime movies, TV shows? I watch quite a few of them. And all these guys talk themselves right into jail. Did you notice that?
Yep.
I mean, the minute the cop stops and the blah, 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 and they break them down in no time and then say, well, your buddy just spilled the beans. You might as well, you know.
Yeah, the authorities are always looking to detect someone's weakness. And, you know, they try to unnerve people, especially those with our beliefs. And if they see they could rail you at all, they will stay on top of you and ride you until you break.
And there is no such thing as not giving them anything. If you talk to them, they're getting something.
Right.
Even knowing that you will talk a little bit, then they'll always come back once you start talking. Well, Eric, we covered quite a bit about the resistance and the CD business and also National Alliance. But how did you ever get started? Where are you from?
Well, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. I was born and raised there. And I must say that I'm very fortunate to have been blessed with having parents who grew up under National Socialism. And I love my parents, and they raised me properly ever since I can remember. I knew what a Jew was before I started kindergarten. And, slowly as I grew older, I began to study more about the problems we face as a people and about the realities of the political situation and as well as the truths about the Second World War. My father was a member of an Austrian Mountain Division in the Wehrmacht, and he fought for 3 years, the last 3 years of the Second World War. He was shot in the face, was captured a couple times, and he really had a tough way to go. My mom grew up in Bavaria, and she grew up basically, she was born in 1938, and that was around a time when the Allies were bombing German civilian towns, trying to break the backbone of the German people. And naturally, my mom and her family had very little. So because of that, my parents never spoiled me as a kid. And I always grew up hungry. Not hungry as I didn't have enough to eat, but hungry and a desire to fight for what was right. And I maintain that until this day.
What kind of education did you have? Did you go to public schools?
I went to a Catholic school for the first 7 years, and then I attended public school. I took some college courses after that, and actually became a tool and die maker by trade, went through an apprenticeship. After high school, I got into boxing. I eventually became a professional boxer, and that was my first experience with blacks. I lived in an all-white area growing up, and once I got into the sport of boxing, a sport that's probably 90% non-white today,
right.
You can see firsthand the racial differences between whites and blacks. And traveling around the country and in the same car with blacks, rooming with blacks, the racial differences are plain to see.
It's interesting how a lot of us got our first taste of integration in the army and things like that. Now that's where I got mine. We lived in a 99% white town or area. I mean, you know, I think there was only one black family in the whole area, and they kept their nose clean, you know. And so when I went in the Army, went into basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, came smack dab into all these blacks from South Chicago. Talk about an experience. I mean, that was a real
culture shock.
So you get it. Now, look, how many professional fights did you have?
I had 8 professional fights. I was undefeated.
Uh-huh.
And I had 7 knockouts all in the first round.
You know, being a leader of a group like you are, you need to have those talents because because sometimes you might have to pop somebody in the nose.
Absolutely.
You're your own bodyguard, huh?
Yes. I don't have a security team or a bodyguard. So I guess I have to handle everything myself.
Well, it's rare to find a leader of any group, especially on our side of the fence, or any side of the fence that's actually been a professional boxer. Usually they're boxers that have retired, you know, and then they got them putting their names on cooking machines and stuff like that. But you actually fought your way there for quite some time and then grabbed it. Well, you were already a racist, right?
Yes.
Yeah, or racial separatist or whatever you want to talk
about.
Yeah,
I also fought openly as a white racist. My ring nickname was the Aryan Barbarian. So people either loved me or hated me.
Right. You know, that's strange because I have a friend that We used to call him Baxter the Savage or something like that, and he became a professional kickboxer. He won a lot of titles. It's Harry Vaquero. He lives down here in San Diego. And he never denied his racial views. When he would go into a ring, and I have videotape of him, he would see Heil one way, all the way around the ring before he started fighting. He had a lot of admiration, especially from the Asians. Now, the blacks, you know, they didn't give him any trouble, but the Asians were highly respectful of him as a straight-out, flat-out white Aryan. Mm-hmm. And he retired, too, pretty much undefeated. He was, in fact, he had been going to go over to Thailand and fight over there, but due to paperwork problems, he never got there. But then he finally decided that he was old enough, he better get out of this before he got hurt bad. Because, you know, kickboxing, I don't know whether you'd agree, but I think that may be a little tougher than just regular boxing when they can kick you any place they want and everything else. It's very easy. You know, they fight to the death in a lot of places in Thailand with kickboxing. Mm-hmm. Of course, in this country, they can't do that. So anyhow, it's quite interesting that you're in, and you still train and everything?
I try to keep myself in shape. I'm 40 years old now, so I don't want to look 40 or feel 40. But, yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned about the Asians had great respect for this open racist kickboxer. I found myself that blacks would have a lot of respect. I stood up for my own people.
Right.
Most black athletes look at their white counterparts as being wimps. Very rarely, if ever, do you hear of a white athlete, white professional athlete, standing up for his people.
Right.
The blacks have always done that. Most prominent probably was Muhammad Ali.
Right.
Cassius Clay, who became Muhammad Ali. He stood up for his people. He refused to go to Vietnam.
Right.
Which I think you agree with.
I agree. Yeah, I agreed. Yes.
So I never had a problem at all with the blacks. Matter of fact, I would go to an all-black gym. And which was, you know, it was a real challenge because just a normal sparring session at a black gym was probably worse than a real fight.
Well, I can say from my experience that I've never had any problems with blacks who were proud of their race. They've always been respectful of me, the black nationalists, the black separatists. And most blacks, once I've talked to them for a few minutes, we don't have a problem. And I've never actually been attacked by blacks, considering all my activity all the years and being the leader of the Klan out here in California. Never been attacked by blacks. It was always whites and Jews. And, of course, the Jews would get behind the whites when they physically attack me. Almost no Jew ever had the guts physically to attack us, you know. Well, I take that back a little bit because of my good buddy Irv Rubin, the intergalactical head and supreme commander of the JDL. He's now passed. God save his soul. But Irv was a pretty stand-up guy, and not like most Jews. He would fight. He usually lost, but he would fight. And so,
right.
Anyhow, I sort of miss old Irv. You know, isn't that something? Even Mark Ahana, I sort of... You know, when he got assassinated, I sort of, you know, you sort of, well, oh, whoopee, but then I'm saying, I don't know, you know, this...
Kahane and Reuben, they're probably what I would call the good Jews.
Yeah.
They do everything, they act like Jews are supposed to act, and I think they're more valuable having them around because...
Yeah.
It'll turn, you know, more people over to our side.
That's true. And I respect anybody who stands up for their people, their culture, their race... their family.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in fact, that's about all I respect anymore because the rest of them are just sort of sheeple, as I call them. Look, Eric, you got your brand new winter issue of the magazine here, 2004 of Resistance Magazine, and boy, this is slick. You know, man, you're making my little old war paper look sort of old-fashioned here. This looks real good. It's nice in color, and you got the Gaty girls on the front, and the Gaty girls and April Gaty, they're real strong National Alliance people, aren't they?
Yes, the Gaty family is, they're some of our biggest activists. Lynx and Lamb, along with their mom April, are always putting out literature, especially in California, dealing with immigration.
Yes, and they were recently featured along with me on that BBC videotape that with Louis Theroux. And they did a great job. I don't know how good a job I did because I couldn't stand that SOB. And he was so obnoxious, and he never would admit whether he was a Jew or not. I don't think he was a Jew. I think he was just a jerk, you know. But anyhow, I got to, well, I met the girls at that rally up in Paris, California, and they sang up there. And I think I met April one other rally. I don't remember which one it was, but anyhow, for sure I saw her again in Paris, California. So that's a real good act, and they've got a lot of future.
Yeah, Lynx and Lamb are the rising stars in the white racialist music scene. They're very talented. They write their own music, and just many times they'll be performing in front of a whole crowd of skinheads, and some of these skinheads will be in tears just listening to these beautiful young girls.
Now, this magazine's got a lot of articles about a lot of different parts of Aryan life or white life. What are some of these articles here?
Well, probably perhaps one of our most popular articles in this issue is we have an in-depth interview with an American GI who just came back from Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't mince any words.
Yeah, I bet he had a lot to say.
Yeah, he does. And I'm sure the top military brass is fuming over the article.
Well, now, how do you get a hold of this magazine?
Well, you can obtain a copy off our website, www.resistance.com, or you can write to us at P.O. Box 67, Hillsboro, West Virginia, 24946.
Now, this comes out quarterly?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
We've also had good luck getting independent newsstands and news dealers, as well as even Arab convenience stores that carry the magazine.
Well, it's very well laid out and very slick and colorful, and I can see where it could probably slip into a lot of places where I don't think I could get in with my newspaper. Well, you know, our newspaper has always been raw to the bone, and the cartoons and everything. However, a lot of those Arab guys, they sure like it, and the Palestinians, you know. But the problem with dealing with the Palestinians and so forth, their leadership is non-racial at all. I mean, we've contacted them on the internet and things like that and say, well, I mean, you know, we have certain sympathy for your problems like that, but we're racial separatists. And they always fire back, we will have absolutely nothing to do with racial separatists. So I don't see much of a future in those people.
Yeah, for years people have asked us, why don't you get together with the Muslims or the Arabs and to fight the Jews? We waited for years for the Arabs and the Palestinians and all the other Islamic groups to do something, but they haven't. And the Jews are able to work circles around them.
Well, I was in New York City a few years ago, and I was there doing some television work on some of the TV shows, and they were going to have a pro-Palestinian march down the streets of New York City. And I said, well, I want to go out and see this, you know. And so I went out there, and lo and behold, they're marching with every leftist Marxist group in the country. And so here it was sort of a strange situation. The JDL was on the side screaming and attacking them. But yet, we don't like those Marxist groups either. But, you know, here I'm watching this. And I say, this is a little bizarre. Why the Palestinians are marching with these Marxists? And we got the JDL here, you know, demonstrating against the whole thing, too. I said, from then on, I said, we're not going to work with these people. I mean, mm-hmm. There's no future in that.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting, however, to see what will happen in the future in this country, since the Arabs are much more rapidly outbreeding the Jews.
Oh, yeah, and their power is growing. And, of course, our position is, and probably yours, I don't know, but we're for everybody in their own country. Don't bother people. We don't believe in imperialism. We don't believe in ruling over these people. We just want to be separate from them. We don't want to interfere. You know, the greatest thing they should like us for, the Arabs or anybody else, we don't want to oppress them. We don't want to be over them. And even like the blacks as a white separatist, you know, you have your own cops, your own government, your own everything. We don't want to be over you. Don't accuse us of wanting to oppress you. That's right. That's the big capitalists want to do that.
Right. What we're striving for is our own white homeland.
Right.
And yeah, we're not supremacists. We do not wish to rule or oppress or enslave any other peoples, especially in our, you know,
right.
area.
But now the problem is that there's so many of these people coming in, and the Arabs and everybody else, that they become an enemy, and we don't want them to have to be our enemy. I mean, but when they move into your homeland, the government tells them it's wonderful, and then you resist, and then we become the criminals. But yet, look how they're resisting over there. Look at how the Iraqis are resisting like mad. But the spokesman for the Arabs and so forth in this country would say we're horrible criminals if we resisted like they do over there.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about a double standard.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What do you think about this big flap about torture over there that we've been seeing in the news in these prisons in Iraq? What do you think's going on there?
Well, I think it's been no secret that the Americans have been abusing Iraqi prisoners. I've been watching, especially at the beginning, towards the end of the war, around when George Bush issued the famous Mission Accomplished statement back on May 1st, 2003, when the American forces would go into Iraqi villages, they would raid the homes at night and basically arrest any male in the home between the ages of 15 and 60, put a hood over their heads, bind their hands behind their back, and just march them off in the middle of the night somewhere, and their parents or their families would not know or anything where these guys were or being held, and still to this day do not know where these guys are being held at or detained.
Well, don't they operate, the American government now, the military, and I don't identify with it at all. We're marginalized out of the picture, so we don't have to say our or we. It's their situation. Don't they take a position much like the Marxists used to take that if you resist us bringing you the glory of wonderful communism, then you're the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
So we're bringing the glories of a phony democracy, and if you resist us bringing you democracy, then you are the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
You notice that? It's just like the Marxists use.
Yeah, it's interesting how the American government has labeled the Iraqi patriots, those who are fighting for their country, as terrorists.
Right.
Or insurgents, where it's the Americans who are the invaders, and they're the terrorists.
Occupiers.
They're occupiers.
And now with this prison-type stuff, now, don't get us wrong, we know the Arabs will torture and do much worse things, probably, to invaders that they caught, but, you know, just a few days ago, they chopped the head off on a man from back east, name of Berg. Well, I say that if I was if I'm defending my homeland and my blood from occupiers and so forth, I don't think anything is out of the question. And one thing, severing a head is much less violent. It's very violent, but also it's a quick death. The body goes into shock. They could torture a man for months and really be in agony. So really, other than the symbolism, which is very powerful, Genghis Khan really used it when he rode across Eastern Europe, it's not that inhumane,
mm-hmm.
even though, you know, when Americans see that kind of stuff, oh my goodness. But when we drop the bombs and we drop the flames and what do you call it?
Napalm
on people. Well, how horrible a death could that be, being burning with napalm and phosphorus and stuff?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's very hypocritical. Just like this incident in Fallujah that happened back in April, where these four so-called American civilian contractors were ambushed, and their bodies were burnt, and they were dragged through the streets and hung from a bridge. It's interesting how the American government responded by probably murdering 1,000 civilians for these four, I would call them mercenaries, who went over there knowing how dangerous it was, and knowing they weren't going to be welcomed with open arms. Yet these guys went over there to basically try to make a lot of money.
Right. they're being paid good money. And it's interesting that they're deathly afraid to institute the draft, which they're probably going to have to, probably after Bush is reelected, if he's reelected. And even if Kerry's elected, they may do that. But that they're trying to fill the void with civilian-type mercenaries. These are just nothing but mercenaries. Now, what I couldn't understand, they took this man that escaped back down to Georgia, and they had the whole town turned out, and they had parades for him like he was some big hero, and he was simply a mercenary that they paid $80,000 to go over there and drive a truck up and down the road. Well, wait a minute. That's not my idea of a hero.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I respect a mercenary, don't get me wrong. In fact, I think any soldier, myself, is much better hiring out as a mercenary than getting chump change and getting your legs and arms blown off for nothing,
mm-hmm.
and ending up in a hospital here in the States that treats you badly. And so I say, yeah, if you're going to be a soldier, be a mercenary and get paid $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, so you can save some money. I know that's a controversial point of view, but it seems sensible to me.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, the Jewish control media has done a great job in propagating the myth that our military, that the American military, is over there fighting for our freedom. I think if they were fighting for our freedom, they wouldn't be over in Iraq. They'd be along the Mexican border here, keeping the mestizos out as they're invading this country.
You better believe it. Well, you know, I hate that we and our all the time.
Right.
Like I'm responsible for this government and what they're doing. I have no control over it. We have been marginalized beyond marginalization. We are the most marginalized group in the country. I can't think of any other group or political philosophy or anything that's any more marginalized than we are. Yeah, but they say we. They take our tax money and do whatever the hell they want. And meanwhile, the country is invaded by millions.
Absolutely. I don't know, if I were commander-in-chief, first thing I would do is put our troops along the Mexican border and shoot any MSTs that try to cross, no questions asked.
And the second thing I would do is grease up the wheels on all those trains that run down the West Coast and all those boxcars, and we'd load up the millions who are already here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I take a radical position. I would go all the way back to 1964 when they changed the immigration laws in this country. And anybody that's a product of anything, any non-white country that came here since then, got to go. I don't care who you are, how many, you're the great-great-great-grandkid or what, you're gone. Now, of course, you have to have a dictatorship to do that. You could not have that done democratically. You know, the answers to the problems that we face, from my opinion, are not going to be solved democratically, because the people are just too slow, too lazy, too materialistic to ever buy into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, democracy is a joke. The one man, one vote system has never worked and never will work.
No. In fact, our forefathers knew that when they formed this country, that democracy was the very worst form of government. And they even put it in the Army manuals up until about 1929. Now, has the National Alliance involved themselves at any time in people running for office or backing candidates or anything like that?
The National Alliance has never ran one of its members for political office.
But there have been National Alliance members, I think, run on their own.
Yes, a few National Alliance members have run on their own, basically just to get the message out.
In fact, I thought there was a man from Michigan years ago, about the time I ran for Congress out here. I don't know if he was a National Alliance member or not, but I always thought he might have been. I forget his name now, but he got a lot of votes running for Congress back then. Yeah. But anyhow, your philosophy, I assume, doesn't have much confidence in the democratic process.
Absolutely not.
So what else is going on with the National Alliance? Now, you've got a radio show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have a weekly radio program called American Listening Voices, which is hosted by Kevin Alfred Strom, and he's doing a magnificent job with that. The listenership is going up every month, and he's doing a great job. He really picked up the the ball after Dr. Pierce passed away, and continued on doing an excellent program.
Kevin Strom, I last time I met him, I believe, was back on the East Coast way back in the late 70s or maybe early 80s, and we had a I had to go back there. Was doing some media, and then I met with the leaders of the Black Muslims back there, and we had a conference there in Virginia. And then several of the Alliance members and I and a lot of other people, we had a demonstration for the South Africans. And I got some nice pictures in my albums about that. I think that's the last time I met Mr. Strom. I don't know why I'd recognize him. I haven't seen a picture of him around lately.
Okay, actually his photo is right on our website.
Oh, it is? Okay.
You could log on at www.nationalvanguard.org.
And that's where you find the radio?
The radio program will also be on www.natvan.com.
Natvan.com.
Yes.
And what are these, MP3 downloads, or do you stream, or what? How do you do that?
Streaming.
Streaming, yeah, okay. All right, well, this, not only are we all getting involved in all kinds of music and everything else, but it looks like we're getting involved in radio program, and we've had, you know, over the years, you know, we produced about 300 television shows, and even though we're not doing any live ones right now, but they're still in circulation, and they're being played in some cities around the country yet, and I just received about 35 or 40 of the Herbert Poinsett's Race and Reason show that he's passed away now, but we are very fortunate to get a hold of him so we can produce them and put them on the DVD and all that kind of CD and whatever and get them out. So that's another thing. All you people out there, especially the older people in the struggle that have got all kinds of historical pictures of the struggle, audio, videotapes, and all that kind of stuff, and real old books on the struggle, things like that, make sure you put it in your will that someone in the struggle or some organization gets a hold of these things when you pass away. Because in the case of Herbert Poinsett, his wife didn't agree with him at all on this thing, and she sort of tolerated it. The minute he was gone, she just dumped everything in the trash. And so tremendous amounts. You know, I had a very sad thing happen years ago. I had a friend in San Diego that had shot a lot of film of the Rockwell demonstrations and the marches and everything. And some of the stuff had gotten around the country, but he had a whole stash of stuff that nobody had ever seen. And he said, well, you know, when I pass away, I want you to have it. And so he lived by himself, and he passed away, and evidently the cops got in there, and whether it was them or the family who didn't agree with him, they got a hold of all this video, 8mm film, and destroyed it. And I was sick about that, because we need to hang on to this stuff. We need to have a very strong historical content.
Mm-hmm. We need to archive it, definitely.
Archive, because we're going places. We're not done, right?
Absolutely.
We're
not
moving up. I mean, look at where we've gone since the 70s. I mean, when there was just a little activity.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much activity back then.
Yeah, we will eventually succeed in our mission. One of our latest projects is music videos. That is a medium that we really need to exploit. We need to use whatever technology is available today to get our message across. And using music videos to reach our white youth, our disaffected white youth, is perhaps maybe one of the best ways to go. A lot of kids today have been adversely affected by watching MTV, for example. The race-mixing videos, the pro-homosexual music videos that are constantly playing on MTV and other stations like that. And I think by producing these videos, especially professionally produced quality videos, showing you know, proud whites singing about positive things about being white, and also as far as protesting certain things, as what they're facing is more or less as being disaffected by today's society, I think that will go a long way into reaching more white kids with their message and bring them along our lines.
Is that sort of like, now I watch every once in a while CMT, the country music, I don't know what the T stands for, I guess it's country music television, and they have a singer and then they have all these cool videos behind them or they're in them, or I mean like a little movie.
Mm-hmm.
Those are terrific.
Absolutely. Young people are very impressionable, and I think a music video is the way to go.
So that would be over then into DVD as opposed to just CD, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. And, you know, people amaze me in the struggle that say, well, it's all over, we ain't going any place. Well, when I look back at when all we had was a few little newspapers and a few little groups, and now there's hundreds of websites,
mm-hmm.
Hundreds of them, and hundreds of periodicals, and people doing all kinds of stuff, and all these CDs going all over the world, and now DVDs. Well, I don't know what people expect. We're sure operating at 100% from the amount of people we have,
mm-hmm.
and so young people ought to look back and say, man, if you think we're not doing anything now, you should have been back way back when it was hard to find anybody.
Yes. I'm also very impressed with the quality of the people who are joining our ranks, the quality of the white people who have decided they've had enough with the system and they're not afraid to put their name in the mix.
Right.
And stand up for what's right.
Now, some people out there think that we're just a bunch of skinheads. Well, I'm a skinhead, but I didn't choose to be a skinhead. Of course, now I'm proud that a lot of my friends are skinheads and like that, and I like to go once in a while to their concerts, but this is a lot bigger operation than just skinheads.
Yes. Matter of fact, the National Alliance membership covers a whole cross-section of white society. Our membership range is in ages from 18 to 90. We have students, we have doctors, we have teachers, we have mechanics, we have athletes. Every walk of life, there are white people who think like us who are willing to be active in the struggle.
I used to say that and I've told the press many times, if you took, say, 20 people that have to be associated or members or associates of whatever group, mm-hmm. white group, and if you put them in the room and said, now, what do these people have in common? They'd never figure it out.
Right.
They would never figure it out because, we run the gamut. I mean, you know, you got poets and educators. We've had professors and all kinds of things like that. And we got working class guys and carpenters and teachers and military people and some police people like that. So there's no way. In fact, and I've said, you know, they say, well, where are these racists? I said, well, you're probably working next to one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But he's just not going to flap his gums around and tell everybody what he believes and get fired from the job.
Sure. It's interesting. I recently did an interview with a Jewish reporter, and the reporter asked me the question. And he says, well, I understand that perhaps your membership is in the thousands, and how do you expect to ever build a white homeland or regain control of this country? And I explained to this reporter that while our membership may be in the thousands, or there may be the number of white activists in the country may be in the thousands, we have at least 10 million supporters, at least. And this Jew asked me to explain, and I explained that in a country with a population of probably 170 million whites, at least 25% of them would not want their children to go to non-white schools. They would not want to live in non-white neighborhoods, and of course, they would not want their children to marry non-whites.
Right.
So the Jew began thinking, well, geez, 10 million, there's only 6 million of us in this country. Started looking a little bit worried. But I think, yeah, our supporter base is definitely in the tens of millions.
Yeah.
These people think like us. They want to achieve, they want the same goals that we want to achieve. We just have to convince them that it's time to wake up and become active?
Well, actually, we can throw it right back on the Jew and say, look, if you're only a few million in this country, a very small minority, how come you have so much power in this country? So if you can determine our foreign policy, you can determine our movies, you can determine all this stuff, and you can't even be criticized, and you're only maybe 6 million or whatever, why, hell, we're on the road. But, you know, the point is, too, I always say, majorities don't change anything. It's the fanatically devoted minority that change things. The majority follow.
Mm-hmm.
They will always follow.
Yes. I mean, it's always been a minority that has led the majority.
Right.
On one end, you have a group of people like us, and the other end, you have a group of people like the Jews. You know, perhaps small groups on each side. In the middle, you have this huge mass wave of humanity who really they're just followers, and they'll go along with the herd.
I think it was the late great Commander George Lincoln Rockwell said that revolution is a spectator sport. He talked quite a bit about that and how it's sort of the masses are sort of like a football game. They like to cheer on their side in this way, you know. And if you're a winner, there's more of them go with you, and if you're not a winner, they're against you and like that. So if you think of them like that, people won't get so excited. Even with the National Alliance, you don't have to recruit every white person in this country to change this country.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to recruit them all to develop a white homeland. You just have to get enough people thinking with their blood.
Exactly. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned this is a spectator nation,
right.
A spectator society. I remember when the Iraq War first started last March, actually March 2003, I was at the supermarket earlier that evening, and I noticed people stocking up on snacks, their tortilla chips, their artichoke dips, everything else. It was like they were getting ready for a big Super Bowl game.
Right, right.
And this war was just another ball game to them.
Yes. Well, that's the thing. It's all because if television validates everything. If it's on TV, it's real. You know, and I found, too, that when I do a lot of television, I did more in the 80s with the big shows, I would find people would stop me on the street, and they would smile and say, oh, I saw you on TV, and it was more that I was on TV than who I am. You know, I had black people stop me and say, oh, I saw you on television, you know. And so by being on TV validates you. Now, isn't that something?
Mm-hmm.
So, and one thing I like about the television is now that with the satellite, we can get the news from every country in the world. They can't control the news like they did. We see Arab countries putting out their version. We see, down in the Philippines, all over the world, and Japan, every country putting out their own news. So you don't have to depend just on the very superficial news here in this country. And also, you see extensive war footage. You see what the hell is going on there, even more than it was in Vietnam. In fact, in a an area where you got cities and houses and stuff like over there, you see much more than when it's just out in the jungle.
Right. Yeah, it's becoming harder for the Jews to control the news. Like they have been able to in the past, and especially with the internet, it's becoming totally wide open.
Right, we forgot to mention that. Other than the fact there's hundreds of white websites. Well, Eric, we're a victim of the old clock on the wall. You're just going to have to come back to California more often. We're running out of time. Well, it's been great to have you on the show.
Yes, it's been a pleasure being here with you, Tom, and I look forward to coming back here again.
I'm sure our listeners will be thrilled to hear the real guy from the National Alliance and the guy that's in charge now, okay? You take it easy.
Well, thank you, Tom.
Well, I was sent to a place in North Carolina to check up on a moonshine still. But when I got there, to my surprise, I could see a little light on the hill. Well, the fire was a-glowing, already I was knowing I was really hot on the track. But in D.C., they said it couldn't be, well, I'll be the one to bring them back. Cause I'm a rebel, new
Yeah, I'm a revenue man. I got a hat in my pocket and a gun on my hip. Damn moonshiner better never make a sip, 'cause I'm a revenue man.
Yeah, I'll get on if I can. Get on if I can.
Well, when I got there, the woods was a bear. They must have gone up on my way. Well, I heard the French shatter as they started to scatter. I heard two or three of them say, it's the revenue man. Yeah, it's the revenue man. He got a big 45 with loads to fill, racking and a shagging to another hill. It's the revenue man.
And he'll get us every game.